Okay. All right. Good afternoon. I hope you had a passable weekend. Let's see. So far there are three people here. So the thought that I had for today was to do as we did before, to look over these tensor product problems to see if anyone had any further thoughts about those. And then look over an old exam and see if we're getting closer to having ideas for each of those six problems. And then I wanted to focus on a topic, and today's topic was going to be Galois theory, or fields in general, so field problems. Okay. Right. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, why don't we start by just looking over the problems. So, those, I should be sharing them right now. Do you see them on your screen? Let me put it into the box. That's... yeah, so that's what I'm looking at right now is the oh right, yes, sorry, yes, that's very reasonable. Yeah, actually that's a good point. Yeah, it is on the screen along with some of the other problems, right? So yeah, that's a good point, because we kind of left off right in the middle of discussing that that question. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, so why don't we just kind of start at the top and run through the ones that we did go in some detail, and then end up at the ones that we didn't really have a chance to look at much last time. Okay. So let's see. So first of all, were there any more comments about say this one or the second one where we're looking at how to understand C tensor over R with C? So that's something that comes up quite a bit. Nope. Okay, and. And let's see, how about the one that we, this more complicated one. So we found some ways to detect the differences between these rings that were sufficient to identify. Did anyone have any further thoughts, any things that we could have used? So I guess last time we looked at the center. Let's see, I forget what else. Oh yeah, and whether it was abelian. Right, and we had some other, some properties that were sufficient to distinguish these rings. Okay. Let's see, and for this one, I think we went through a pretty clear example, unless there were further comments about that. All right, and then for winter 2008 number 5 here, yeah, so this one again, I think we worked that one out pretty thoroughly. Okay, and so then winter 2009 number 4 here, again, I think we managed to figure out how that localization worked to get the desired ring. Okay. This is a good question. I worry that my sound is not working.
Hello, Professor. Can you hear me?
Because I do not hear you. Just type in the chat window if other people do, because I think it's maybe my sound. Okay, yeah, that's my sound then. So let me try to fix that. Okay, could someone try speaking again? I think I should be able to hear you now.
Hello. Hi.
Yes, now I can hear
Okay.
you.
Okay.
Sorry about
Great.
that. Okay, thank you. Yep.
Thank you. So I was just wondering about fall 2018 problem two.
Okay.
Can we just quickly go over what are the dimensions of these things? I just want to double check.
Oh yes, as real vector spaces.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so did you want to tell me what you were thinking they were, and then we can see if we agree?
I am not sure because I was
Okay.
okay. Maybe I can start to
Okay.
see a few. I could be very wrong. So for the first one, I think the bases are either 0, 1 or 1, 0. So it's two dimensional.
Okay, so no. So
Okay.
so let's try to figure out why. So this is as a real vector space that I want to give a
Oh,
basis.
real. Oh, sorry. Okay. Then I know. Okay. Sorry. I was thinking about, yeah. Okay. So
Okay.
it's either 1, 0 or I 0 or 0, 1, 0, I. So it's four dimensional.
That's right. Yeah. So this is for, that's exactly right. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry. I was, my head is messed up. And so for B, it's eight dimensional because we can have either one. Wait, sorry, let me see. Yes, we can have either one or I on each
That's
end, and
right. On any single one of them is enough to generate exactly just like you did on the first one, right? Okay, that's right. So that's right. So that's A and B.
for C, I think it's still the same that we can have one or I on each entry of the matrix.
Yes, that's correct. And now there are four entries, so again we get eight. Right.
Okay, and for D, that's, oh, I guess four dimensional because we can have one on or zero on
That's
each.
exactly right. Yes, okay.
For E, it's 4 to the power of 4.
That's right. Yeah, not to the power. Just like before, you can put any one of those four at each spot. So it's the product. Oh, I guess it is. Sorry. So you're right. Yeah.
Just don't worry. Sorry, I wasn't expecting.
It's just four times four, right? Because there are four things you put here, and then four things you put there, and then four things you put there.
So it's like 4 times 4 times 4.
So yeah. So it looks like this. So a basis is something like this, and then I, and then J. And then K, right? So that's four things. And then you can put 0, 1, etc. So there are four of these, and then there are four of those, and there are four of those. So it's just four times four.
Okay.
That make
Actually,
sense? You don't get to put, you don't want to choose a different thing for all four of them at once. You just take one of them and then make a basis for that, and then another one and make a basis for that. Just like you did previously.
okay, but there are 4 places I gotta choose, right? It's like 4 times 4 times 4 times 4.
Well, so because you're going to choose one of the places that you're going to make have a non-zero entry,
Yeah.
and then for that choice, there are four choices.
Okay.
So 4 times 4. So this is the location.
Oh, what am I thinking? Yes, yes.
Right? Okay, yeah. So it's a direct, it's a product rather than a tensor.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes. Okay.
Okay.
I have,
so we agree?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. And then for the last one.
Okay. There are, so I'll just say it step by step. So
okay.
For M12R, that's 4. Yeah, and then for the second one is 4. So it's for, yeah, I think it's 4 times 4. Like we pick one from the first one and pick one from the second one.
And no, so these are again products, just like we had up here. So instead of choosing one, either one or I for each one, right? You chose a position and then put either one or I there, and then you chose a position and put either one or I there, right?
Okay.
So the same thing can happen when you take this product. You're going to choose a position and then put a one on one of the 4 spots.
Okay, so it's 2 times 4.
Yeah, so it's 8. And a typical basis element would look like this. You'd have a 1, 0, 0, 0 for the first one, and then all zeros in the second. Right? That would be a typical basis element.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh. Okay, thank you so much.
There are 8 of those.
I was very unclear about these things, but now very clear. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and actually, for me, it helps a lot when it's crazy and confused about adding or multiplying and these things. For me, it does help a lot to just try to write out what my actual basis elements are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right, any other comments or questions about these earlier ones? Okay. Okay, so then we were looking at once again C and C tensor over R with C. This time we're trying to get a little bit finer details. We were trying to understand it as a C algebra, and I think we did that. Although if there are questions about that, I'm happy to talk about that one a little bit more. Okay, and then. We were, and this I think is where we were when we finished up last time. We didn't really get a chance to say much about spring 14 problem 6, where we were trying to figure out whether this was a field that we ended up with. Okay, so maybe we can just take a moment to think it through again, just because it's been, you know, a weekend. And actually, let me remind you that I think of this as somewhat analogous to, so here we have a field C, and we have an extension field, which is this C adjoint X or C adjoint Y. And this is sort of analogous to where we had R, which had as an extension field this C. And we've been studying in quite thoroughly the tensor product of C with itself over R. And so to me, this is somewhat analogous to what we're doing here, where we're taking the tensor of extension C adjoint X over C with that same extension. Right. So yeah, so maybe people could just spend a moment, because we were trying to discuss, actually we had basically decided that we thought it wasn't a field, but we were trying to figure out why. So why don't you just take 1 minute to remind yourself of where you were with that, and then I'll see what thoughts people have had about that. Okay, let's see. So why don't I just switch over to the other board because it's, I think, easier to see because I can write more. Okay, so so we were looking at this C tensor over C adjoin X, tensor over C with C adjoin Y. All right, so what did people think of for to trying to detect whether this new ring is a field?
We can construct a ring homomorphism, or I'm sorry, not a ring homomorphism. We can construct a homomorphism, and if that homomorphism has a non-trivial kernel, then there is a ring ideal, which means that it is not a field.
Right. That's a good way to do it. Okay. And so we're going to build a homomorphism. Let me just give this thing a name R just so we don't write it all out. And you're going to, okay. And so R, you're going to map. So where are you going to map it?
So I decided to map it to CX.
Okay. Okay.
So,
okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. So,
I started by defining a homomorphism on the direct product of CX and CY, and then that extends to the tensor product by the universal property of tensor products.
Exactly. Okay, very good. And so you had to, so you're going to build this bilinear map.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. And so, what was your map?
My map takes p of x times q of y.
Okay.
To p of x times q of x, where that's just regular function multiplication.
Okay. Right. Okay, that looks good. And so then what has to be checked to make sure that we fit our diagram here?
So we have to make sure that it is C bilinear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I said R1 P1X plus R2 P2X. QY. That's going to get mapped to R1 P1X plus R2 P2X all times Q of X.
Mm-hmm.
And then multiplication is distributive over addition.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can factor out the R1 and the R2 in both of the terms. And what we're left with is R1 times the map, which I call phi.
Okay.
R1 good. Phi P1X QY plus R2 phi P2X QY. And then the other check to see if it's C bilinear, mm-hmm. PX, and then R1, Q1Y, R2, Q2Y, that's the same argument.
Right. Right. So, okay, very good. So we have that it's bilinear. And so then, as you say, we can just apply the universal property, right? And that mm-hmm. gets us... this map here, did you give a name? Let's say Psi. Okay.
And then I applied this map Psi to the element 1 times y minus x times 1.
Okay. Got zero, I guess.
Yes, because this is going to give x minus x.
Good. Okay.
And I guess,
yeah,
I could try to make an argument why this element that I chose 1 times y minus x times 1 is not 0, but I would have to, like that, yeah, if that were true, then 1 times y would equal x times 1, but y is not an element of C, and so you can't multiply over to the other side of the tensor product, because y is not in C.
Okay. Okay, all right. So, right. Okay, so then you've got a map, and it's got a kernel, and I guess, and it's not the zero map, right?
Yeah, it's not the zero map because we can plug in 1 times 1 and that gives us 1.
Right. Okay, very good. So we have a non-trivial map between ostensibly between fields, and so it's not a field. Okay, does that make sense? Any further comments or questions about that one?
Could I hear the logic of why this shows it's not a field just one more time?
Yeah. Did you want to do that, or shall I? Yeah.
No, I was asking if we could recap. Ah,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So why is this not so? So the outline of the structure of the proof. So we use the universal property to get. Okay, so we have a map R to a field, which happens to be C0x, but the whole point is this is a field. Actually, I guess that's not the whole point, but it is a field, so that's fine. But this is a ring homomorphism. Okay, hence the kernel is an ideal, two-sided ideal. Well, okay, if R is a field that has only two ideals, the zero and itself. If the kernel is zero, then it has no kernel, but we just found something in the kernel. Okay, so it has a kernel. And for it equal to I equal to R, but we found something that does not go to zero. So u with psi of u not equal to zero. Okay, so we contradicted both of those two possibilities. So we get a contradiction. And the only thing we assumed was that R is a field.
Gotcha. Thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions or comments about this problem?
I did it in a kind of different way.
Okay.
And can we probably talk a little bit about it, because I'm not sure if what I said was rigorous. So I was basically trying to use the definition and say that there exists an element in this ring such that it doesn't have any inverse.
Okay. So you're going to find an element, little r, say, in this ring R with no inverse. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
So the element is pretty similar to what Kobe found. It's x tensor 1 plus 1 tensor y.
Okay.
All
right.
And assume that it has an inverse, which looks like the sum of ai tensor bi over I. And just multiply R with R inverse, and we should get 1 tensor 1.
Okay, so we just compute, and we get 1 tensor 1 is equal to R inverse is equal to, and we compute, and okay, and let's see. So I guess you're going to get... AI
tensor Y BI plus the sum of X AI tensor BI. And this is where I'm not sure if what I'm saying is rigorous. So I want to say that if I move one of the sums to the left, then it looks like the sum of AI tensor Y BI plus 1 tensor 1.
Oh, let's see. So let's be a little bit careful. So these A's and B's, so they are elements of C adjoin X and Y respectively, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And I want to like rearrange this equation and say that on the left hand side we have 1 tensor 1 plus the sum of AI tensor YBI.
Oh, I see. You're just moving it over. Okay, so you're going to rewrite it. So you got 1 tensor 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're moving this term over to the other side. Okay, so this would be minus the sum of AI tensor over Y with BI is equal to the sum XAI tensor BI, like that?
Yes. Okay. And now I want to say that any tensor on the right-hand side has to have a factor of X in the first place, but there is nothing on the left-hand side to match it. I'm not sure if this is rigorous to say.
I see. So the tricky part with tensors, and actually it's a little bit tricky up here too, is the argument that things are different, right? So the argument that this is non-zero, it takes a little bit more work than that. And the argument here, that's also where you have to be a little bit careful, right? Because some things are in this are identified, right? And so you just have to make sure that the things you're saying are not identified, right? So you want to argue that
because we can't move things that contains X or Y around.
Uh-huh. Right. So, I mean, you can do things like this, right? So you could say that since you can move out the X, I mean, it depends a little bit on the structure, I guess. So, let's see. Yeah, I'm not sure how to say it. So you're trying to now argue that, okay, so let me see. So there are a couple things you can say. So one is you could view this object, if you wanted to, as a CX, as a left CX, right CY module, right? Because you can multiply on the left by CX and on the right by CY if you want to. And so then you could rewrite this, if you were thinking of it that way, as X times the sum of AI tensor bi.
Okay.
Right. So that at least would make sense. And now you want to argue that this side is not x times anything.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Right, but I'm not quite sure how to do it. I let's see.
What I would say is that we can't extract any x from the first one tensor one term, even though we can extract some x maybe from the second term.
Right.
But I am also worried about canceling out and.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so maybe one of these cancels with one of those. It's.
Okay. Maybe the.
No, so for example, maybe one of the terms, because if we remember where these are, we could have had one of these terms could be one tensor one over y, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, and so then, I'm sorry, before you multiply by y, that could be this AB, wherever that went. That could be this term here.
Yeah.
And then when you multiply it by y down here, you'll end up with one tensor one.
Mm-hmm.
And then that'll cancel with this one.
Yes.
So then you'd have to argue that the rest of them don't. But, you know, if, for example, you had something like r inverse is equal to one tensor one over y plus x tensor one, right? If you were to try that. Then when you go through, then the equation you end up with is that 1 tensor 1 minus 1 tensor 1 minus x tensor y is equal to this.
Yeah.
And those will cancel. So then it will be divisible by x. I mean, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Okay. Yeah. So I feel like with tensor products, it's really kind of complicated to argue about things whether things are going to be equal in either of these settings, simply because there are so many ways in which things can become equal. Right.
Yeah, I'll think about it. Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, what I see.
Okay. Does that make sense? All right. Other thoughts or comments about this one?
I also have, that was the problem that I was thinking about over the weekend, but
all right.
I don't know if we've kind of beat this dead, but it's kind of your schedule outline. I have something slightly different to add that maybe.
Okay. But, all right.
Do you mind if I share my screen then?
Oh, no, please. Yeah, you should be able to just do that.
Let me figure out how to. Okay, there we go.
Got it. Okay.
Can you see this?
Yes.
Okay. This is less about contributing a solution and may more so contributing an anti-solution, I guess. So the way I started with this is I had a bunch of little notes and things to think about, and I really wanted to, I mean, you can already see what was going to go wrong this area right here, but I wanted to do that same idea of trying to find a, you know, an ideal or a kernel or something that's going to make that not true.
Okay.
So I first tried to pretend like I was taking this and I ended up, so here's the original problem.
Okay.
And my attempt as if I was taking this test, this is the way I thought of all of these objects. Because the way that it was phrased is that these are all C algebras and that there's this all this structure and all these things you have to be careful of. Mm-hmm. And it completely slowed me down, and I don't think I did it efficiently. So then I said, well, I'm not taking a test. And I looked in Rotman, and this also is a question I have for you. But so this is the how to think about it in terms of the definition, that you have a product of modules,
okay,
over rings, and that they're mapping into a billion groups. So I realized then that if you're thinking of this as in a billion group, it means that this, you're losing sight of the, I think you're losing sight of the addition operation, but you're losing sight of one of the operations. Mm-hmm. So I was very careful, and I went through and made sure all these things were the right. And then at the end of the day, I reached, this is everything that we already talked about, is taking a product and all that. Mm-hmm. I reached a statement that was, since these are just a billion groups, I don't know, even if I found the kernel, if that in itself would tell me the truth of why it's not a field. So I guess the thing that I learned from doing this problem is that the universal property can really slow you down. And I think the solution to this was that idea of the correct choosing a tensor. And I think that if I were knowing what I did with this problem, I would have forgotten all of the universal property and focused on this problem. Okay. And then you have enough to write it up nicely. So, I mean, maybe this helps someone, but I think that was the big thing. I'm sorry, I forgot your name that you were speaking, but the fact that you did a CX was kind of the trick, the pitfall that I fell into, is I wanted to take their product and I kept their variables. Uh-huh. And then that makes it very hard to see what is non-zero. So I reached a statement very similar. I said, okay, so then I have the product XY. Mm-hmm. And I can also get that by doing just the typical, or the, not typical, the pure XY tensor. Mm-hmm. And then I reached this statement where if this is not zero, then I sort of win. I found something that was non-trivial when it should be. But that's such a hard problem. I don't really know, you know, like yeah. you were saying before, it's really hard to tell. So I think the real trick here is that if instead I did just CX, which was really clever and smart, then yeah, then this whole thing comes out to be like a nice solution. So anyway, that was my take. And then because I was reading through the book, I found this that I thought might be helpful. It seemed like a very prelimmy type of question. But if you tensor, since we talked about that divisible idea, mm-hmm. if you tensor over Z and one is finite, mm-hmm. and the other one's divisible, you always get zero. Just as an idea, because you can pull out the divisibility thing.
And zero. No, that's handy. And it'll include some examples like, yeah. So like Q tensor over Z with something.
Yeah. So hopefully that helps someone. That if my failure is at least something to learn from.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And as you said, it is often tricky when you're trying to argue directly with tensors because it's very hard to tell whether they're the same. Right. It's very hard. Well, it's not so hard to tell that they're the same. It's hard to tell that they're not the same. It's hard to identify. All right. So yeah, and again, when you were commenting with putting the C adjoin X and Y over here, so the map that you would presumably were using, right, which was this one, right? That map, this map is actually then going to be an injection. So it's going to take this ring and actually C algebra and embed it into this field over here. But it's a proper subring.
Yeah, and multiplication and addition didn't work well. You can't come up with a very nice algebra map between them because of how it came out. So.
There should be a good C algebra map. In fact, what these things ought to look like are things where you've got rational functions that have some kind of polynomial in the numerator, but in the denominator, the polynomial factors into a product of x's, p of x and p of y, q of y. That's what you should be seeing.
Oh, okay. I actually didn't break up the bottom like that. That's smart.
So, but that's what this ring really is in some sense. And when you multiply two things like that, you still has that factorization, right? But some of those things don't have inverses. And the easiest way to see that is, as you say, what was suggested earlier is this map into this onto actually this field. Right. Okay. So again, as you say, this universal property is mostly for abelian groups, which means that you're thinking of this. So the way that I think of that is that this object I'm thinking of as a Z C bimodule, and this one I'm thinking of as a C Z bimodule. So then when I'm done, I get rid of this C, and all I'm left with is a Z Z bimodule, which is to say an abelian group. But then you have to check and see whether your product structure is consistent, et cetera, if you want to do it with the universal property. Okay.
Is there any advice you can give? I mean, now I know to try to cut down a variable, but is there any reason why I should have seen not to include the Y?
Well, I think that to me, what's the easiest way to start thinking about this is to go back to this example, where I have, again, a tensor over a subfield of an extension with an extension, and work out, in this case, it's easier to see what's going on, right? Because you have a clearer way to write this, and we just went through it in several problems. It's still not easy, but it's easier because you can write this as a four-dimensional real vector space. And then in that vector space, you can actually work with objects. And since you know it's a four-dimensional vector space, you can identify when things are not zero. And that's the problem down in this example. It's not so easy to tell when things are not zero.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Right, but if you want to study this one, you can get a map of this one to C, which is onto C, and it has then a two-dimensional kernel. We saw in one of the other problems that as a ring, it turns out to be isomorphic to this. And that's the kind of thing that you're going to get down here also. Okay, so we've said a lot about this one. Any other questions or comments about this problem? Okay, let's see. So if we go back to the exam we looked at last time. So that's kind of where we finished up last time. There is one more problem here, but I don't know if it's... worth the time to look at this. It's fairly similar to something that we saw earlier, that this fact about tensoring over R with quotients. And then it's a situation again where you try to work out something with an explicit basis. It's a good one, I guess, to try on your own. But much like what we were doing up in this other case, it amounts to sort of understanding an explicit basis and trying to see how that works. Did anyone want to see more about that one, or shall we move on to, let's see, so what I had for today is another exam to just run through, and then some problems related to fields. So well, I guess this one is also related to fields, but specifically Galois-type problems. All right, so why don't we just try that same exercise that we've done before and just look over this exam. Let's try to go, maybe we'll just go through this one quickly so we have time to look at the Galois things, but here it is. So so can everyone see that, or should I paste the address into the chat box again? Okay, so yeah, why don't we just spend like 3 or 4 minutes and run through that and see if you can get a feel for whether those are now problems that you would have a way to tackle. Okay, let's see, are people ready to comment on thoughts here? All right, so let's look at this first one. All right, so how? Any thoughts about how to approach this?
I was thinking about the trick. Sorry, excuse me. So if A times A transpose is So that, sorry, the transpose of A times A transpose is A times A transpose. So sorry, like, yeah, it's, and wait, never mind. Actually, I'm not really sure what I'm talking about. Sorry.
Okay. It's true though. But, okay. All right.
I was thinking of more, just a more direct thing. Assume we have a term in the upper triangular area.
Okay.
Not on the diagonal. And what ends up happening when you multiply A times A transpose, let's say that you've got an element at A, at row N, column M. So when you do A times A transpose, what ends up happening is that you're gonna get an extra term in the NN entry.
Okay.
But then when you do A transpose times A, you're gonna get an extra term in the MM entry.
Okay.
Which would mean that the multiplication of those two matrices would not be commutative.
Okay, yeah, so sort of by directly computing, essentially, these facts, right?
And we can't have that N is equal to M, because in that case, the term would originally be on the diagonal, which we assume it was not.
Right, yeah. Okay, yeah, so you're sort of getting mass shifted along, I guess, from the N to the M. Okay, any other thoughts, ideas for how to approach this? Okay. Okay, and when you do it, you'll see actually maybe why the reals come in instead of C. Okay. All right. So this may be direct. And actually, maybe we'll just go through this as we go along. Does that look like an easy one to get started on, or one to wait until you've done some of the others?
It looks like it would be a lot of index chasing. So I think that like it's probably straightforward. It just looks like it's a lot of heavy lifting.
Okay. So lots of writing up, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you can't get anywhere on anything else, at least it gives you something to work on, I guess. Okay, what about two?
This one is very similar to other ones that we've talked about a couple of times now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would definitely start with this one, because I feel like this is one that I have the solution down by this point.
Good. Yeah, and as you see, it actually comes up pretty regularly, so it's a good thing. It's a good thing to keep in mind. So three now is the smallest prime, right, that divides it, since there are no two groups. So. Okay. And any other comments on that one? All right. What about number three? Any thoughts? So this one I would classify in the list of useful theorems that you should know. And it wouldn't hurt also to know the proof. Because they're basically asking for a proof of a theorem that you might end up citing otherwise. So for example, what does it say about a finite field? So it says that the multiplicative group is cyclic, and that's one of the more useful facts about finite fields. So So if you know how to prove that, then you can do this one. Okay. What about number four here? So which theorem is this?
The notation here is confusing me a little bit.
Yeah, okay. The notation's awful. All right, so
what is meant by the Rx divide?
Doesn't the first one just say show that C is not, or C is equal to isomorphic to R and R? But I agree. Yeah, this, it seems like the notation is intended to slow you down.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan.
I could be wrong. But yeah,
I think part of it was just poorly typeset. But I think that this is how you would normally see that, and then it's the ideal.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say C because not plus one. Sorry.
Right, it's minus one. Right. So, and then this is. The idea, this just means ideal generated by that. Right, so that's the notation. Right, and as you say, had it been plus one, it would be C, but it's minus one. And so so then you can use, so which is the theorem that tells us what that is?
The module decomposition, yeah. Which is one of the...
That's right. As written, Chinese major theorem is one of its names.
Yeah.
So the classification of modules or PID is another name for it. Right. But that's right. And so then you'll get, in this case, you'll get not C, because if that were a plus, it'd be C. If it's a minus, you get R plus R. So, right. Okay. Yeah. So, I think it's just poor typesetting. I would have used a double... dollar sign. Once you get a typeset right, then it's, I think it's not so hard to see this first one. And what about this second one? So I claim once again, this is Chinese major theorem, and this is actually not even close to being isomorphic. It's pretty far apart. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about that one?
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay.
I thought that the Chinese remainder theorem only applies when the ideals are, what's the word? Mutually...
I guess
you're not maximal. It's the property where the sum of the two ideals is the whole ring.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that true here?
Okay. I guess you're right. The Chinese major theorem is usually used as a sub case of this more general statement about classification of modules. So the way that I would get it into that Chinese remainder theorem would be to refactor this as x plus 1 times x minus 1, right? And then those two ideals will have that property, right? And then for the second one, it would end up being the squares of those two things.
Okay, yeah, it was specifically the second one that I was talking about.
So
okay,
for the second one, it'll be the squares. And those two will satisfy this and that. But what you'll end up with is something that looks like it's going to be isomorphic to Rx mod x squared for both of them.
Okay.
Yeah. In particular, it's even got the wrong vector space dimension. So it's... Yeah, so you're right. For the actual Chinese remainder theorem, you have to say which two ideals you're talking about. Right. Or more. Okay, other comments or questions about this one? Okay, number five.
Would this be direct computation?
Essentially, yeah, right.
Using division algorithm?
Yeah, you can try to use division algorithm. You have to be a little careful because it's not Euclidean, right? So something's going to go wrong. But the division algorithm will get you some distance anyway, right? But yeah, you can just try to factor like that one's factors, and it's pretty clear that this factor is, right? Because I can see a 3 there, right? And then actually, since they do not have a greatest common divisor, and this one has, and this the second one has these two, this also happens to divide 9. So then you can just compute that. You can kind of do it by hand. The tricky part, though, again, is trying to show that the things don't have further factors. Right, so you want to show that, for example, 3 is indecomposable. And there's a trick to that, and that is that this thing has a norm. So use the norm. Yeah, if I take, it's because it's embedded in the complex number. So if I take a plus b root 5, root minus 5, its norm is just going to be that times its conjugate, and so that's going to be a squared plus 5b squared. And when you multiply two things, their norms multiply. So that means that there's a way to say that there are only finitely many things to check. Right, because the only things that could possibly divide 3 have to have a norm that divides it. Okay, so yeah, it's kind of a direct computation, but a little bit tricky. Other comments or questions about that one? Okay, and what about this last one? Then we get a chance to think about it a bit. It's kind of long. You have to read a lot to get to figure out what's there.
The first part is, I think you just play around with the geometric series formula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And since these are formal, we don't really care very much about, convergence and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. You just play around with it, and you can prove it quite directly, actually. Yes, that's right. Okay, so there are two things here. Prove this, show that. And actually the second one similarly, but most of it's kind of figuring out exactly what it's asking you to show, what, you know, what constitutes showing that all ideals have that form. But it's very much, it's very similar to what you just finished proving. So once you prove that these things are invertible, if and only if they have a non-zero first entry, that really plugs pretty much directly into proving the second part. It's kind of a corollary of the first part. Okay. All right, let's see. Any comments about this exam? Does this look like one that where we've mostly under control? So this fact about fields is going to come up in today in some of the problems that I have next. It's a good one to know. Okay, let's see if there are no further comments. So as I said, I have some problems related to Galois theory. I could first say something a little bit about you know, the fundamental theorem of Galois theory, etc. Or we could just start in on one and it'll come out in working on the problems. Is there a preference? Maybe I'll bring up the problems while we consider. Yeah, so there are problems involving algebraic extensions and whatnot. So do people feel like they can get started just playing with one? And then if there are questions, we can go back and write out theorems. Okay, all right. Yeah, so why don't we just spend a minute or two and try this first one. And obviously if there are questions, please ask. And yeah, maybe people can just chime in when you have thoughts about how to approach this. Maybe I'll just sort of collect useful theorems about fields while we're at it here. So. Okay, let's see. So I see a comment in the chat. So this is supposed to be, I guess, an idea toward showing that this is algebraic.
Yes, this polynomial has root alpha plus beta.
It does. Okay. All right. But it may not, however, have coefficients in F.
Alpha and beta are both
in K.
Oh, they're. Oh, I see. Okay. This is fixable.
Okay, but that's right. Okay.
Yeah, because the definition of algebraic is that there is some polynomial with alpha as its root, and there's some polynomial with coefficients in F that has beta as its root.
Correct. Yeah, so I guess so we have these polynomials, say Q and R, which are in, let me call them A and B. A and B, which are in F adjoin X, and A of alpha is equal to 0, and same with B of beta. That's right. That's the structure that we have, right?
So then we can add together those two polynomials. That gives us another polynomial in F.
Oh, okay. So. So actually, does anyone know another way to get that a field extension is algebraic besides explicitly presenting a polynomial? Yeah, they could be kind of complicated polynomials. Okay, so maybe I'll recommend another theorem here that's true. So theorem if we have an element of an extension field, then it's algebraic. Over F, if and only if the field it generates is a finite dimensional F vector space. Yeah, we do need P of alpha plus beta is equal to 0. Did someone come up with something? So the tricky thing is that if we take something like P of X, yeah, right. Because if you take something like P of X is equal to A of X plus B of X minus A of beta minus B of alpha, and just plug in alpha plus beta, these are just numbers here. These are going to have higher order terms, right? So actually finding polynomials can be kind of tricky. Okay, right. Yeah, so this is fields, right? Okay, so can anyone see how this theorem about finite dimensionality of the extension could be handy?
Is it that F adjoined alpha plus beta has to lie in between F and K?
That's right. Yeah. So that's right. So, right. So often with these fields, it's helpful to just kind of keep track of all the fields you've got around and which ones contain which other ones. The nice thing about maps between fields is they're always injective, so or zero. So there's so these little diagrams capture everything about the maps, right? And so then, as you say, there's K sitting up above here that contains both of those, right? And then there's also the field that contains their sum. Which contains F, okay. And sorry,
this doesn't look like the right diagram to me.
It's true though. Is there? I mean,
well. Oh no, I'm trying. I'm thinking two steps ahead.
Sorry. Oh, okay. All right. I mean, I haven't written anything false. I don't believe, even if it's
no. Yeah, not, this not is
giving
this
us is the true answer we want, right? Okay. But did you have another field in mind? There is another field I want to add to that diagram, actually.
Yeah, F adjoined alpha and beta.
Exactly, that's right. And where does that one live in our diagram? Obviously, it contains at least two of those, right? Oops,
yeah.
That's a beta, right? Because it contains that, and it contains that. But what about the middle one?
It also contains that middle one.
That's right, exactly, yeah. It does. That's exactly right. Yeah, and so if we want to use this theorem down here, since we have this containment, it's enough to argue that this new field that we've added is finite dimensional as an F vector space. And then we'd be done. Is that clear?
So our argument is that since alpha and beta are algebraic over F,
mm-hmm.
then the extension from F to F adjoined alpha will be finite dimensional.
Right.
And then the extension from F adjoined alpha to F adjoined alpha and beta will also be finite dimensional.
Right. And that's because it's again algebraic, because it was algebraic before.
Right. So yeah. Then the path we take going from F to F adjoined alpha plus beta to F adjoined alpha plus alpha and beta Mm-hmm. That means that each of those extensions must be finite dimensional as well.
Exactly. That's exactly okay. The argument. Does that make sense, everyone? Since the index of F adjoint alpha in F and the index of F adjoint both alpha and beta in F adjoint alpha are both finite. So is the index of this F adjoint, the sum over F. Okay. Does that make sense? Any comments or questions about that?
I'm a little bit curious about this theorem itself. So okay. Would it have some, what's the reasoning behind it? If we have some algebraic, so I think one direction is like a slightly more direct, like if we have an element that is algebraic, then we're gonna have a finite dimensional vector space, like the extension is gonna be a finite dimensional vector space over F. But what if we have a transcendental element, and why is that not going to be finite dimensional?
Okay, right. So let's say so we can talk about how to prove this. So let's see. So which direction did you say was easy? Let's do the easy one first.
I would say that if the element we are joined is, if R is finite dimensional, so okay. if F adjoint R is a finite dimensional vector space, then I think my brain also have a problem. If I don't write things down, then I'm just completely
it's frustrating that way. Yeah, that's why I'm writing constantly. Yeah, so but this is the direction you want. So if this is a finite dimensional, then we want to say that R is algebraic. Okay, and so let's prove that. Okay.
Sorry, no. So I think the other direction.
You want to do the other? They're both true. So okay. So we can do the other. But okay, let's just start with the one that's already written, just because it's written. Okay. So so if we have this finite dimensional, then I claim that R is algebraic. And why is that? Because I'm going to start writing down 1 and R squared and R cubed, etc. And let's say this finite dimension is D, and I'm going to go all the way up to R to the D. So now I have D plus 1 elements. Okay, and I have D plus 1 elements in a D-dimensional vector space, so there's a linear combination that's 0.
Oh, and this is the function we're trying to find?
Exactly, that's our polynomial.
Okay.
All right, so that's how you build the polynomial if it's finite dimensional.
This is fancy, okay. This looks interesting.
Yeah. And then for the other direction, it's kind of similar. So B, if it is algebraic, so if the sum of AI RI is equal to 0, that's what it means to be algebraic, right? If I just take the span of the vector space span of these powers of RI, so the set of all things is the form sum of bi r to the I forms a field. I guess here's another way to say that. I think it's cleaner. So, or in other words, I can take my field. This is the way you normally build fields, right? So you take your base field F, and then you enjoy it a variable, and then you take a quotient by this irreducible polynomial. And this gives us an extension field. And it contains the root that we wanted, so this is our F adjoint R.
Okay, that's very clear. Thank you.
Okay, great. Yeah, so it's actually useful to kind of remember how those arguments work, and certainly it's a useful theorem to remember. Okay. Okay, any other questions or comments about this one then? Okay, so let's look at another.
Do you need some condition that P is irreducible, minimal?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote it in little tiny letters over here. Yeah, and abbreviated it enough that it's not clear what it said. But yes, you do. Right. You have to choose one that is minimal, right?
And you could just write that. Does yeah. That seem reasonable? Okay.
That's very reasonable, yeah. Okay, so here's an example of basically what we've been talking about, where they want you to actually come up with some numbers and a specific basis. So why don't people just try that for a couple minutes? Okay, and just jump in when you've got either you think the dimension of that vector space is or some elements of a basis.
It should be degree 4, right?
Yeah. And again, what I would always do is just draw my little picture. So Q, and then there's Q join root 2. Q join, yeah, that's a good basis. Thank you. Root 3, and then Q join both. And these are quadratic, so they're all both going to be two-dimensional. And then this top one is either the same thing or it's also going to be 2. And as you said, it's going to be 2. And then someone has also written a basis. Okay, any questions about this one?
Just a very general thing. So if the question says find a basis, then we don't need to justify too much in order to get all the points.
That's a fair question. I think the exams usually right at the top to cover their bases, please justify all answers. So it wouldn't hurt to give some justification.
Yeah. Okay.
How might you justify it in this case?
Hmm.
You could show that all four of those elements are in Q adjoined root 2, root 3, mm-hmm. and that they are linearly independent.
Correct. Yes. So, for example, how would you show that root 3 is independent of the first two?
Suppose root 3 is equal to some linear combination of those and show that it doesn't hash out.
Mm-hmm. Right. And since the left-hand side is rational, the right-hand side is rational, so A equals B equals zero, contradiction. Yeah, so that's the kind of argument that you could use. Okay. Any other comments about this one?
Yeah. When in the first part, when we were finding the degree, would it be sufficient to just state the degree of this extension is 2 because x squared minus 2, for example, is the minimal polynomial over this field? Would just stating that?
That's, I think, fairly sufficient? Clear. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, quadratic extensions are always a degree 2. Okay, other comments or questions about what to write on this one? All right, let's try another. ideas about how to approach a problem like this?
I suppose we could assume it has three elements or five elements, but that seems a little.
That's a good point, though. It is often, though, a good idea just to start with some small examples and see what happens. That's certainly. Right. And if we did have a field field like F3 or F5. How do we see that this subfield generated by elements of the form X cubed is actually everything? Clear. So I would be thinking about this theorem that we have at the bottom here about what the multiplicative groups of finite fields look like. That makes sense. So maybe we can just go through how this one works, and maybe that'll clarify how it works in general. So if we use this fact about what the multiplicative group looks like, then this field, it's got zero, of course, which is not part of the multiplicative group, but then everything else is in the multiplicative group. So it's going to have one, and then it's going to have some generator. And since it has only two elements, that's going to be the whole thing. For this one, there's zero, of course, and then one, and then a generator, but it's cyclic, right? So we have x squared. And x cubed, and then, right, so this is going to be equal to x squared here, and this one's going to be equal to x to the fourth, right, because it's a cyclic group. So then if we take all of the cubes, this will be a cube, right, obviously, and 1 is always a cube. And then if I take x and cube it, then I get x back, right? So all those elements are cubed. And down here, of course, 0 always is and 1 always is. But then if I take x and cube it, I get x cubed. And if I take x squared and cubed it, I get x squared. And if I take x cubed and cube it, I get x. So again, I get every element as a cube. Okay. Does that make sense? So it helps to sort of understand the structure. Okay, so from that, using the fact that all the multiplicative groups of finite fields are cyclic, do we get a restriction on what our field would have to look like if the cubes were not everything? Does that make sense? So if we have this cyclic group of a cyclic multiplicative group, and we want that the cubes are not all of the elements of that group, so what does that tell us about the order of the multiplicative group? So the other thing one can try is, if it's not clear, you can just kind of keep trying the small examples, right? So those didn't work, but if we go up to, say, F7, right? So this will be 0, 1, x squared, x cubed, x to the fourth, and x to the fifth. And this time, if we try to generate the cubes, of course, 0 is always a cube, and 1 is always a cube, and then x goes to x cubed, and x squared goes to x to the sixth, which is 1 again. And so the cubes are just 0, 1, and x cubed.
Is it helpful if you looked at an element that wasn't a cube and figure out its relation to the generator of the cyclic group?
Mm-hmm. That sounds very helpful, right? So if we have, so this is a good example, because here we have four elements that are not cubes, right? Okay, and how did it work? So these are, you know, powers that are not a multiple of three, right? So we're going to need that Q minus one is divisible by three.
Wait, why is that the case?
Why? Because if it's not divisible by 3, then if it's not a multiple of 3, then when we look at, so otherwise, this multiplicative group, so FXQ, which has size Q minus 1 elements, with multiplication, is a cyclic group, and if I look at the group contained in it, which is generated by x cubed, this is going to be the entire group, right? Because the cyclic group is generated by anything which is any power that's relatively prime to the order of the group. I don't know, is that clear?
I have to ask something very basic. I'm very confused about by the notation like 0, 1, and x. I'm more used to looking at 0, 1, and 2. And so, okay. So it's like Z mod 3Z. That's what I'm used to.
Uh-huh.
And why is x squared equal to 1 in this case? Like in F3, for example.
Yeah, because I'm using this theorem here that the multiplicative group is of a finite field is cyclic. Okay?
Okay.
So
okay.
That means that something generates it. I don't know what. It might be 2, it might not be 2. But it's okay. Some element of my field that generates this multiplicative group as a cyclic group. And I'm just calling that element X. So this is some generator. For this particular case, 2 does work. Although for F9 or something where it's not a prime, it's not as clear how to write the elements. Because usually get them, they're usually polynomials, and you have choice depending on which irreducible polynomial you chose, right? So, but even for the ones that are primes, you have to think a little bit to decide whether X is actually whether 2, say, is a generator. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Okay.
But the theorem says that it's cyclic, and so something is a generator. Quite a few things are generators. But at least one, and I've just named one of the generators X.
All right, that's very clear. Thank you so much. That's a lot of things clarified. Thank you.
Okay, good. Okay. All right. So are these? Is it clear what happens here with with F3 and F5? Everything was a cube, and so the thing generated by the cubes was in fact everything. For the F7, it's not true that everything is a cube. But so how do I know that F7 doesn't have a non-trivial field contained in it generated by the cubes? But can we just list the subfields of F7?
Can we say that because 7 is a prime, there is no like proper subfield by
yes.
just the...
Yes, you can say exactly that. And so once you have any of these elements in there, then it can't be... then it's going to generate the whole field. When I start adding 1 and x3 together and multiply and take the other operations of a field, it's not a subfield. So, right. So as you say, since it's prime, this has no non-trivial subfields. Okay, let's see. So what do people want to do with this one? I could leave it and let you think about it. I could tell you an approach or we could, and So maybe what we can do is take these facts and try to summarize. So this is a good thing to do, is to just do some small examples. All right, we did some small examples. So then we can go and start over and try to figure out what we learned from our small examples and what we can do to try to get a proof. Okay, so... So we want to say that if we had a subfield that was generated by these cubes, okay, so all right, so let me see. So first of all, let me just claim if L is not equal to F, so L is equal to the set of cubes. Okay. So then we can also work out its size. So the cardinality of L is equal to, well, so those are the set of cubes, so it's going to be the zero element, zero. And then it's going to be the ones that are cubes, so those are going to be the size of F minus minus one, that's going to be its zero, divided by three. Okay. And C, the size of L is going to be P to the R, which has to divide, and so the size of F is going to be the same prime to the S, otherwise it's not a subfield. So do those three facts all make sense?
I personally don't remember anything about the order of, finite fields. Like, does it have to be prime powers?
Yes, that's okay. Correct. That's okay. That's actually a really good term to have down here. So theorem there is up to isomorphism exactly one. Field of order P to the S and no other finite fields. Yes, so they're exactly the prime powers.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And while their isomorphism types are the same, and that's actually a non-trivial fact, the which ones are contained in which other ones is also interesting, but it's certainly true that if one is contained in the other, then they have the same P, just different powers. Okay. And so now I claim that if you just play around with these facts, that's very restrictive, and there's nothing but four works. All right, so in particular, this B and C, if I take a P to the R, so and if we have P to the R equal to 1 plus P to the S minus 1 divided by 3, then P to the S is equal to 4. And that you can just compute directly. Okay, I don't know how limiting that was, but in any case, there's a couple of useful facts about finite fields, and that's an approach to proving that one. Any other comments or thoughts about this one? Okay, so let's move on, because it's also one of the less common types of problems is this one. So let's look at one that's a little bit closer. Actually, that one is just no. Let me one more. Yeah, so this is kind of a direct Galois type problem. So let's try that one. Okay, so does anyone have any thoughts about this one?
I'm still trying to write it out, but I think that if we multiply together the Galois conjugates of alpha, then that should give us, so like x minus alpha times x minus the Galois conjugate of alpha.
So alpha is your name for this element?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry, I gave that name alpha.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That should give us the minimum polynomial of f in q of x.
Okay, so you're going to build the minimal polynomial.
Yeah.
Okay.
This might be a whole lot of algebra, though. That's right. Not necessary.
You will notice that this is something that they specifically note you're not actually required to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
But you could, right. So
I'm going to take the test writer's suggestion and not.
Okay. So what I would do whenever faced with a problem like this is to first just kind of figure out what fields are lying around. Because of this, fundamental theorem of Galois theory that relates those fields to subgroups of the finite groups. So if we just start here, what fields are kind of pop out at you? So obviously there's Q, but what else is here?
Q adjoined the cube root of 2.
Yeah, so that's a very natural one to throw in there. If I join the cube root of 2, and what's the degree of that extension? Oops, that's a 2, right?
3.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the polynomial x cubed minus 2 is irreducible in Q, right? Okay, and is that Galois? In other words, does my polynomial split?
No.
No, right. And actually, there are several ways to see that. Do you have an easy way to see that it doesn't? One is that this field embeds in R, and two of the roots don't. So that's one way to see it. Since it doesn't, if I want to get to the full splitting field, what more do I need?
Roots of unity.
Uh-huh. So and what's the degree of this full splitting field? So if this is the splitting field for cube root 2. Well, once I factor that off, I'm left with the quadratic.
6?
Yeah, 6, exactly. So this has to be, the biggest it could be is 2, and it's at least 2. So it's got to be 2. So this is going to be, join this cube root of 2, and then one more root of unity, let me call it omega, right? So this would be the splitting field. Okay. All right, so this is now Galois, and do we know what the Galois group is for this?
Well, since Q adjoined cube root of 2 is not Galois, when we draw the corresponding subgroup diagram, that group right there needs to not be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And the only order 6 group that I know of that doesn't have a normal subgroup, or the one that comes off the top of my head, is S3.
Right.
And also, I'm pretty sure that's the only one.
It is the only one. And another fact is that it has to be a subgroup of S3 in any event.
Oh, yeah, because there's only two other groups, and they're both abelian.
That's actually, yeah, just one, actually, which is abelian. Yeah. That's right.
Oh, yes, just one.
Yeah. Okay, and since we know that it's S3, now we can just draw the full subgroup diagram if you want to, and that'll give us all the subfields, right? So Yeah. Right, and so let's see, so there, S3 has four subgroups, five subgroups. Right. And three of them are like that. Okay, so they're just those fields here, and you don't really have to worry too much about exactly what they are. But that's the full list. Right? Okay, and how is this related to alpha?
So Q adjoin Q root of 2 is the field given by Q mod the minimum polynomial, because alpha is in that thing.
Right. Yes, that's right. Alpha is in there, and since there are no subfields of that except for Q, and alpha is not in Q, yes, we have to check that. It's gonna generate that field there. Okay, and so then does this tell us which the splitting field is?
Well, it couldn't. So we already know that Q adjoin Q root of 2 is not Galois, and splitting fields are Galois for characteristic zero fields, base fields.
Right.
And there can't be anything smaller than a degree 2 extension.
Right.
So the other one that we have at the top, adjoined also with omega, has to be the splitting field, because there can't be anything in between those.
Exactly. So we built the splitting field for alpha, right? And we managed to do it without ever building the polynomial. It's actually not that hard to build the polynomial, but we didn't have to. Right? Okay, any questions about this one? I think it's kind of a good one, because it forces one to kind of go through the picture for Galois extensions. And I hope it's clear that the answers are that this is S3 and this is S6.
Why is alpha contained in a field in the middle?
Why is it contained? Because we can just build alpha once we have this cube root of 2, because that's equal to this alpha, this is the square of the cube root of 2 at the end here. So this is, so if I have cube root of 2 in my field, then I just take 1 plus the cube root of 2 plus the square of that. And it's in there. Does that answer your question? Right.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. This is a field. It's not just a vector space spanned by one in that element. In fact, it's dimension 3, so it's got one more generator. And these three things are the generators of the vector space, are some generators, are form of bases.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions about how this one works? Okay. And you could work out what these other ones. This is going to be omega. This is going to be omega squared. And this is actually going to be I there. Okay. All right. Another question about this one. All right. Let's see.
Sorry, can I ask just one last thing?
Please, feel free. Yes.
So we're trying to find the splitting field of x cubed minus 2, right?
Technically, we're trying to find a splitting field for the minimal polynomial of alpha. We didn't work out what the minimal polynomial of alpha is.
Mm-hmm.
I claim that you could, but we didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but we managed to figure out what the splitting field for its polynomial must be, whatever its polynomial turns out to be. Okay.
Okay.
And we did it by studying the splitting polynomial for this other, the splitting field for this other polynomial, right? Which is which is not the minimal polynomial for alpha. It's some other polynomial, right? Because alpha is not a root, We decided to study it because alpha has this clear relationship to a root of this one. And once I join the root of x cubed minus 2, I've got alpha in there. So that makes it a useful way of getting my hands on a field which is Galois and contains alpha. Does that make sense?
All right, yes, it does. And when we're trying to look at the roots of x cubed minus 2, what are the roots?
So- okay. In you mean just in C? So I mean it's it's got one real root and then these two complex roots like that, and I'm labeling them omega. Oh, I guess I called it omega squared. I shouldn't have called it omega squared. So it's let me call this eta instead. Eta and then cube root 2. Those are the three names that I gave for the elements, but in any case, those are the roots once you embed it in C.
Okay, and so the splitting field for this polynomial is the cube, adjoint cube root of 2 and omega?
Yes, so you have to add two elements, right?
Okay, and eta is some powers and product of this, the other two roots?
It is. Okay. That's correct, yeah.
I need to review my knowledge about polynomials, but yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, right. And you kind of knew, and you knew that because of the theorems that were mentioned, that the largest degree that a Galois extension can be is the degree of the minimal polynomial factorial, because you just keep adding roots and at least one linear term has to factor off each time. So that's so then you know that eta somehow has to be expressible that way, and then you can work out how to do it.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Okay, other questions or comments about this one? All right, let's see what else. Got here. Yeah, this is another similar one. It's a good exercise in practicing with it. So let's just spend a minute and see what people get for this one. Okay, let's see. Does anyone have any thoughts about how we could get our hands on the dimension of the splitting field? 20 seems like a very good guess. And how do you get 20?
So I created two field extensions off of Q.
All right.
I adjoined 5 root 3. Oh, I'm sorry, the fifth root of 3. Yeah, that's right. What I meant.
Okay.
That has field, that has degree 5.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that this can't be the splitting field because it's missing the fifth root of unity.
Mm-hmm.
So my other one that I created was Q adjoined with a primitive fifth root of unity.
Okay, which is probably better notation than what I used last time. So let me call that omega. So omega to the fifth equals 1 primitive. Okay.
That has degree 4.
Mm-hmm.
The splitting field will be some super field of both of them. And
mm-hmm.
But 5 and 4 are coprime.
Yes.
And so it has to be exactly the product of the degrees.
Okay. At least. Okay, and is this one a Galois?
Yes.
Yes, that one is. All right, unlike the one over here. Okay, very good. So yeah, so that's going to be the right answer. All right, any questions about this kind of problem?
For what or how far can you generalize this to it? It seems like if you have x to the n minus something that is not an nth power, mm-hmm. Should it always look like n times n minus 1?
That's a very good guess. The fact that these are relatively prime is helpful. If that's not true, let's see, that would... that would be more confusing. But as long as this is a prime, then it's pretty, then it works nicely.
Okay.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, are there questions or comments about this one?
I just want to clarify that the splitting field is exactly Q adjoined fifth root of 3 and with omega.
It is. That is correct. That is what it is. So this is exactly Q adjoined the fifth root of 3 and this omega. That's right. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I just don't know too much about this.
That is what it is. And you can kind of picture why that might be so, because you've got this fifth root and these are the 5 roots over C of your original polynomial. And this one is the fifth root of 3, and this one is omega times the fifth root of 3.
Yeah.
And this one is omega squared times the fifth root of 3. So you've got all of those in there now, right? So I can now express my original polynomial as a product of linear polynomials just using these elements here.
Yes.
So I can factor completely. So that's what you need to get it to be a splitting field.
Right. All right. I guess the logic is that we can somehow get this fifth root of 3 from those roots. How to say it? So the product of these roots can somehow be fifth root of 3. So shall we?
Well, so the thing is that at this point it's fairly straightforward because we gave the fifth 3 to 3 we adjoined, and then we adjoined this omega by itself, right? We just adjoined that, and now we just keep multiplying by omega, and that takes us to the other roots.
I think I didn't make myself very clear. So what I was trying to say was that if we directly express what this splitting field is, it will be Q adjoint these 5 roots. But we simplify it and can say that it's Q adjoint 5 root 3 with omega because we can somehow get omega from the combination of these roots.
That's correct. That is correct. Yes. You could define it to, as you say, to be the one where you join all the roots in some field that contains all of them, like C, and then for convenience of understanding the dimension, we try to do it with as few pieces as possible, and we did it with 2. That's right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, are there comments or questions about this one? Okay, so we're about out of time, so maybe I'll just sort of look through what the remaining ones are. Okay, actually, can we do this one immediately? So this is just to find an irreducible polynomial over Q for which the order of the Galois group is not the factorial of the degree of the polynomial. Does that make sense? So the past 2 problems are both examples of this. At least the last one, right? Because it was only order 20.
X to the fourth minus 2?
Yep, x to the fourth minus 2, perfectly good, right? Yep. Cyclotomic ones are even easier to remember. Anyway, yeah, that's right. Very good. So that's an easier one than the other ones. And let's see. And here's another one. You're playing around with field extensions and looking for whether they're Galois or not. Okay, and again, you're going to end up drawing your diagram of subfields and try to figure out which ones are Galois by which are normal. This is kind of a fun one. Construct infinitely many non-isomorphic quadratic extensions of Q and use these to show the abelianization of the absolute Galois group is not finitely generated. The absolute Galois group is an object of great interest, so this is an interesting fact about it. And this is a little bit complicated because you have to show that the groups that you're building are the fields you're building are not isomorphic. So you have to figure out how to show that 2 quadratic extensions that you are not isomorphic. So that's something to think about. I think that's the last one that I had. Okay, so tomorrow I'll come up with another topic to look at. Would people like to consider at least one of the problems that we looked at today to think about more and try to write up some sort of details to make sure that this topic is clear? If so, please volunteer for one, and then I'll know which one to.
I can do the weird for the finite group with order 4.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting one. All right, good. Anyone else? Okay, well, anyway, I encourage you to choose one on your own and write it up because it's good practice. And then you can see if everything made sense or something got glossed over. And then otherwise, I guess I will choose another topic. I was thinking maybe representation theory next time. I guess we're out of time. So I will see you tomorrow. That would be, oh, and also you should think about whether there's another topic that you really do want to see. I'll do representation theory tomorrow, but then think about whether there's a topic you're feeling we're not getting. Okay.
Can I vote for?
Oh, please, please, yes. What do you
Chinese
look for?
Chinese
meter theorem. Chinese meter theorem and module type things. Okay.
Yes.
All right. That's a good idea. All right. Okay. And you can advertise one now or think of one and request tomorrow.
Can I add just a little bit? So
okay.
If we're going to talk about modules, how about we talk about projective and free modules too? I'm just
okay. All right.
I don't
All
want
right.
to.
Yeah.
Or
so,
other people.
Yeah. No, that's good. So those come up. So the sort of categorical aspects of modules of projectivity and freeness. Yeah, those are good concepts in the module theory. But CRT in particular comes up fairly frequently. That aspect. Yeah. Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
All right. See you.